Blog Talk Radio.
To Masonic Effects. I'm your host for the next while. You can call me Graham or Dale or whatever. It's good to have you here. We are this is an interesting time of year. We're celebrating the this is the 8th of November 2015, coming up on Remembrance Day, so we'll have a few words about that. This is the 312th day of the year, believe it or not. That leaves only 54 days left. Time to squeeze in celebrations of our culture that predate the modern contemporary monotheistic faith by quite a bit, actually. Takes us back, of course, and very grimly, we celebrate. Celebrate is an odd word. We acknowledge the death of one of the absurdities of mankind, war that we can launch on each other for some very remarkable reasoning that doesn't stand up well to the test of time in all cases, but the seriousness of the event, the absurdity is shrouded in the fact that we're talking about the deaths of many, many people. I'm not a person to, I feel it creepy when I'm in a community that has little plaques commemorating every tree, every bridge, every death. I find that just creeps the hell out of me, because I'm still part of the living, and for some Philistine to think that I need that in order to remember is a bit insulting to the memories of the people living. Should I be plagued with that every single day? Not as a part of a public duty. I have other things in the imbalance. And am I saying that creeps the hell out of a lot of other people? Yeah, it does. But on this day, there is no honors enough, nor too little, to pay tribute to the people that have given their lives in wars over the years. Today, I want to just remember not only our dead, we weren't out there fighting against ourselves. How do we conjure up this notion of enemy? Since the First World War, our governments have become quite precise at the art of propaganda. When it's for us, it's a matter of information. When it's against us, it's propaganda. Same thing, manipulation of the masses. Still goes on to this day. As long as people are immune to studying history, I guess we'll be subjective to that form of, I don't know, crassness. Think this year of the Battle of Stalingrad. Nothing like this ever happened where I've lived. It was considered one of the more important battles in the Second World War. And it went on between the 17th of July 1942 and the 2nd of February 1943. and some consider it a turning point in a war, bloodletting, I guess. The German military committed 270,000 men, 3,000 artillery pieces, 500 tanks, and 600 aircraft to that battle. The Soviet, they put up 187,000 men, 2,200 artillery pieces, 400 tanks, and 300 aircraft. Let's say they were outmanned and outgunned. By the time of the Soviet counteroffensive, the German military had committed 1,011,000 men, 10,250 artillery, 675 tanks, and 723 planes. The Soviet Union matched the Germans for manpower, but they had shorter supply lines than the Germans and could move more heavy firepower to bear. The Soviet forces eventually numbered 1,103,000. They threw men at the battle. It's hard to determine the number of casualties. It's estimated that the German army lost more than 750,000 killed, missing, or wounded. Records show that the Soviet army lost 478,741 men killed or missing and 650,878 wounded. That's a million. Just to give you a bit of an indication of scale, entire U.S. Army lost 416,800 men through the entire Second World War. Here's one battle. .75 million men killed, missing or wounded. No, more. In one battle, 1.75 million. Civilian casualties were less well recorded. Estimates vary between 4,000 and 40,000. It's where people starved. That's because largely as a result of the German air bombardment and the ferocity of the battle, Stalingrad was reduced to ruins and much of the civilian population had fled. What was left, starved. Today we know Stalingrad as Volgograd. Volgograd. No, this isn't a competition. No, it's not a matter of forgetting anything. Just filling in the blanks. Filling in the blanks. A very sad part of our history. Thank you. what end? To what end? What's gained? What's lost? You answer for yourself. It's hard to do this kind of a program. It's a bit melancholy. A bit. It's grim. It's part of us. Imagine. A politician could convince himself it was justified to drop nuclear weapons on innocent people in order to be successful in battle. Imagine that one of us, another human being, could justify a weapon that would kill, would vaporize everything. 200,000 people at once. The scream, I've not been trained to do that, nor do I've had mixed feelings about that, because most men and now children around the world, I don't think it makes a fellow a man. I don't think it makes it honorable that we're taught to kill. It's a necessary function. It's a position that there but for the grace of God. But I've never met a good soldier that would ever want to anybody else to have to stand in front of that danger in his place. He's doing duty. And for what purpose? To carry on a meaningful existence without living in fear. At least that's what I'm told and what I'm taught. But I'm in a law-abiding nation. Up until the last 9 years, we were known for that internationally, and I gather that we're trying to regain that ground. Not that we haven't been in pitched battle, not that we don't support our friends. Certainly not the case. Well-trained, honorable, dedicated men and women. No. Sad, though. Total cost. World War I killed more than 9 million combatants and 5 million civilians. 14 million people. Cost $186 billion in direct costs and $151 billion in indirect costs. Does that matter? There were over 37 million people killed. 16 million deaths, 20 million wounded. The enemy, 2.85 soldiers were serving in the Western Front with another 2.85 million when the First World War came to an end in November of 1918. And it's said that the Germans alone had 5 million casualties. 1.75 million dead. I don't know. Does it matter? In the Second World War, Russia lost a total of 29 million people. Back then, we were brought in under Great Britain. It lost 495,000. These figures are astounding. And we wonder why these countries arm themselves and take every possible indication of threat so seriously. Today, we only have 36 million people in this entire country. In those years, Russia, or the Soviet Union lost 29 million people. The United States lost 413,000. I don't know, you do the math, eh? You do the math. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. This is Masonic effects. It's interesting we're talking about this today with some element of sensitivity. Because it's a grim part of our celebration of freedom that we can recognize for ourselves what other people have done for us. Whether misguided or not, their aim was clear, and I appreciate that sincerely to my grave. But you know, if you want somebody to become a true Mason, if you're doing what you can to provide the tools that he requires to be to arrive at his full potential as a Mason, then what you're stirring up is an element of insight and sensitivity. He'll be aware of the pressures and egos, the pettiness in the lodge. Some will be better at tolerating that than others. Some will not care, not think about the greater good. It won't matter. That's just the way life is. Our lodges are microcosms of the communities that they're in. Although you and I might want to think that they're a special environment, well, the potential is always there. I always thought that Freemasonry was a way to stop the Philistines at the door. You know, the uncouth, the foul-mouthed people with no manners and no sense of decorum or purpose, or not able to feel comfortable with any level of dignity, but make it seem something smarmy that they can do, pretending, living, lying, pretending, being hypocritical. As stewards of the order, we are not fulfilling our obligations to those who search for nirvana. Nothing wrong with that. I thought that's what we offered. Make a good man better. We went beyond the physical plane a long, long time ago in orders like the York Rite, many of the consistory being part of the occult rituals, and Rosicrucians. And within the 3 degrees of the Craft Lodge, we find those elements are included. But we also find men choose not to look, turn away, claiming that it's over their heads. Their own mediocrity keeps them pinned to the ground where they stand. Those who search for nirvana are looking for something beyond the pain. Nirvana, that place where pain and suffering no longer exists. Where is it? Joseph Campbell refers to that as our bliss. And teaches that it is so close to each and every one of us. Freemasonry is a portal to that state. A nice social experience doesn't wrap around the need for spiritual growth. My goodness, have you never gone to sat down with the pious in a conventional church or synagogue or mosque and seen some of the pettiness that goes on? Oh, me bad. It's only me that sees or experiences that in one place in the free world. cut it out. Happens all the time. As our membership fades, the principles remain undiminished. In sharp contrast with the state of ambivalence that brings men to us, men come to us in that state of ambivalence, unsure, searching, and not really aware of what it is that they seek. But they know they have that craving, that sense of drive, that sense of dissatisfaction, that incompleteness that they want to fulfill. And we offer them up. Think about what it is that we offer them up. We offer them very, very little. The excitement and stimulation and promise of the initiation process, without linking that to anything more substantive than the lip service to a journey. Your journey. Well, we knew that coming in, didn't we? How are we going to help you on that journey? Oh, you're on your own. That's yours. And when are you told that? Every step of the way. So we teach that the process of that journey includes these enriched, mysterious plays, rituals. But just as we're getting in there, we realize this is a remarkable process, a remarkable, uniquely individual experience that connects us with history. And then it's not that the book of secrets and potential is slammed closed. Then we realize that it was never opened in the first place. It's been left on the shelf for decades. Funny that the political maneuvering goes on. A lot of pretending, yeah. But all that is, all that amounts to is the struggle. Pretending that you've found something that you truly haven't. It's terribly unfair to the person that has to do it. I think it justifies a sense of pity, most of all. Pity the man that's close to experiencing insight, awareness of himself, and yet doesn't care or doesn't know, and goes along with the charade. How sad. Better a man is clueless. And his purity, that's what he is. Absolutely guileless, doesn't know, doesn't care. Then to mock his own progress, to be a caricature of his own progress. Here I am acting as if I'm this fulfilled human being when in fact I'm hollow inside. Then how do you know? Listen to how he talks. Listen to who he associates with. Ah, does he associate only with people that are of some benefit to him? Well, my, the cat's out of the bag, isn't it? Telling somebody the process of becoming involves death of the ego. If you're going to become this, does not express why one of us would want to do that. What the hell is the ego? Why does it have to die before I can fulfill myself? So we come up with some populist tripe. You're good at that in North America. Always the shortcut to insight. You know, let's define it as some type of hallucinogenic process and then drug ourselves into that state of enlightenment. Well, except that doesn't work. But until we experience a psychological death, we cannot find what we seek. we aren't set free by our physical death. We seek awareness. How then do we learn to control and overcome the selfishness of our own personalities? That wounded pride that can drive us into all kinds of delightful madness and absurd behavior. Absolutely absurd behavior. Freemasonry is a celebration. But think of it, it's like a thoughtful process when men get together. Men of some degree of, let's call it breeding. We used to call it breeding. I don't know what it's called anymore because that's not considered proper training then. Men of some training that know what good manners is. The good manners to show hospitality to one another in certain settings. My goodness. That's been a train wreck in some places because that's not on masonry. That's on the individuals. That's on the boys that we're letting come in, where they're not taught. There's high expectations, but nobody teaches them. Here, let me give you a little example about history and what one could have considered bad manners. Listen to this little wartime tune. I think you'll recognize this from 1946. Some of you who have been there, and thank you, and thank your fathers and brothers and mothers and sisters.
Linger in my arms a little longer, baby. Hold me tight. While my love for you is growing stronger, baby. Sing right to say goodnight. Though it may be getting past your dreams. Don't think twice, just linger in my arms a little longer, baby, cause it's so nice, it's so your dream time, baby. Don't
Second World War tune. Hmm? This is what you would have been listening to when you had a bit of leave. Yeah, Peggy Lee. Do you remember? She died not too long ago. Oh dear, 1946. What were we up to? Hmm? We've got Prescott and Summers coming to the Sankey lecture in a couple of months to talk about what happened at the apple tree. You know, that tavern where representatives of lodges, not all the lodges, a couple of lodges, maybe three, maybe four, more showing up from one primary one lodge than the others, to talk about whether they needed to get, wanted for some purpose in forming a grand lodge, a coordination, the cartel, cabal, masonry. Mm-hmm. What did we come up? What came out of that? I don't think is what we have today. I can't imagine that that was set in motion, anticipating the clamor, billboards advertising, and some of the mercantile approach to Freemasonry that's taken over in our haste and our general anxiety that it's all going to collapse because it's within the control of the physical dimension. My goodness, so much of Freemasonry, the thought will not die. Whether we're clumsy, seem to be clumsy at what we do, as we continue to be clumsy at what we do, decline, the sharp drop-off in Masonry is going to be, I think, a real interesting distillation, a process. Not to harden, not to get us into hardliners, but to, and softliners, to right and left, not polarized, but to bring together the philosophical underpinnings. Here, let me share a little bit with you from what will we do today? A little bit about the development of the Royal Society. Remember, we were talking previously about the relationship between old Buckingham and the King. Remember that? And how Buckingham was a bit of a screw up, and the King, but he was good friends with the King. You know, how many people can the King have? This was Charles the First. Now, Charles was raised to think that he had this notion, whether it was by the court mandarins that raised him or not, that he was linked to the divine, and he conducted himself with that degree of what you and I would consider arrogance. When we see a person of a divine nature, we are suspicious because they are so uncommon, but there's something familiar about that understated confidence. Not some pompous little fart. Well, Charles historically has been described to us as a pompous little fart. So he had a vested interest in keeping his buddy Buckingham in office. So we knew, and he encouraged Buckingham. That was his. And Buckingham may say, "Well, we'll declare war on Spain, and you go and take care of that." And he called a parliament, remember, hoping that they would give him enough money to go and fight those Catholics. Well, it's, you know, that's the mentality of the day. But
Parliament was newly elected, and they were raising their eyebrows thinking, wait, this is our leader? The guy doesn't make any sense. He's a fool. If you listen to some of the things that he's saying, they're just flat out wrong. He's part of the Flat Earth Society looking over the edge. Jeez. So for the very first time, the king from Charles met with these guys. He was greatly resented because he wanted more delegated authority. The Charles' war with Spain was intended to get more money from Parliament, but he was offered the absolute minimum that Parliament could afford him. It's like, yeah, you are the king here. Make it last. Buckingham was such a screw up that Parliament said, we can't have that guy running around. He's just crazy. Let's pull him in. So they wanted him impeached. And they used their powers of taxation to insist that the king consider their options. So in other words, we're not going to raise taxes and turn them over to you unless you pay attention to what it is we want from you. Get rid of Buckingham. So Charles did what all despots do. He dissolved it. What do we call it? When you just postpone our parliament, it just happened a couple of times in the last few years here in Canada. Anyway, he just dissolved it. It doesn't exist anymore. But he did that because parliament was ready just string up Buckingham. They were going to impeach him. They were going to literally hang him. And they would then put him on trial for treason, and then there was a good chance he might lose. But the problems didn't stop there. The French, of course, being the upstanding bunch where the king banned the Huguenots, this Protestant sect. And they became the hunted in France. So they took off, ran out of the country, fled, and crossed into Britain, the Protestant safe territory. This is all back in 1627. Can you imagine? And he was trying to do something about Buckingham's public image, his reputation, which sucked. So he sent him off to, said, okay, we'll here's a naval command. And go over to La Rochelle and help the Huguenots. How hard is that? How hard is that? Here's the Navy, go over there, help those poor buggers and bring them back. But Buckingham being Buckingham, anyway, Parliament wasn't going to help this. Buckingham had screwed up, so Charles started to do things a little bit dodgy to get some money. He simply forced the gentlemen, landed gentry, successful merchants, to lend them money. And if they didn't pay up, he threw them in prison. Yeah. Extortion. So this really angered, it's not like the gentry didn't have connections. They saw what was going on, and they found out why. And they said, this is not going to go well for you, Charles. And so Charles, fortunately for the Parliament, ignominious in a sense, 1628, he had to call Parliament. He was broke. And they weren't going to give him a nickel. And they demanded that they give them a petition of right before they would vote him any money. So he was sulky and he signed off on the petition, but never took it at all seriously. He just ignored it. I'm the king, I can ignore it. You guys have no power over me. So Parliament and the king on the same track, going in opposite directions. Charles was worried about the state of Buckingham's reputation. Well, big loser. The man was a loser. He was incompetent. So he sent him on another, this is what you do. You send the knucklehead on another expedition to La Rochelle. Can you imagine? Again, just bring the human. There you go. Huguenots over there. They're trying to get out. Go over there, get them, bring them back. But then, meanwhile, they would have been overrun and slaughtered by the Catholic French. This, a parliament saw this and said, what do you mean? They're Protestants over there. You sent your buddy over to get them, and all of a sudden they're being massacred because knucklehead couldn't do the job, and you knew it the first time. This is like the third time. What are you doing? And they blame Charles for it. Well, you know, big dog couldn't take the responsibility. So they passed a bill saying that anybody who furthered popery, now see, this is like, what are you doing? You're making it easier for the Catholics. They said anybody that furthered that or helped the king to collect taxes, unless it was authorized by Parliament, was a public enemy. In other words, the country was now Parliament. And the Commons barred the door against Black Rod. We still see that when Parliament's opening. Black Rod, you know, bangs on the door of Parliament because they've been barred. And again, here goes. He says, all right, I'm going to just dissolve you. You're not paying any attention. And who do you think you are? I'm close to God. It's 1629. You no longer exist. Well, Parliament didn't get that memo. So he went on for 11 years ruling without a Parliament. 11 years. But unfortunately, Charles I had been crowned King of Scots at Holyrood House in Edinburgh in the presence of Archbishop Laud of England. And this officiation as a Scottish coronation by an English bishop was seen by the Scots as an attempt by the Episcopal Church to move into their kingdom. Remember, this is the land of the Kirk. This wasn't a place where some central authority was granting favors to the people. This was the Scots. And the Presbyterians of Scotland weren't very happy with this notion of the English bishop crowning the King of Scots. Like, who's the Episcopal Church produce? Who? What's this, Anglican, huh? So Charles, possibly with a view to extending his lucrative church attendance tax, ordered that the English prayer book was to be used in Scottish churches henceforth. He saw the attendance tax as a source of revenue. Hell with the people. Maybe you could do that in England, but the hell with the Scot? Scottish king wasn't the king of the people. He's the King of Scotland. The people were a whole other matter. King of England was the king of the people. Not so in Scotland. The first issue of the prayer book was made, set for public use, the 23rd of July, 1637, at St. Giles Church in Edinburgh. Beautiful place. It was packed, but not to listen to the readings. Now, this is a beautiful little piece of not in my watch or not. Inside the church, there was a cabbage stall holder named Jenny Geddes. Jenny sat there and listened for a second, picked up her stool and threw it at the priest who was about to read from the English prayer book. Whether she did it or not, the whole place went nuts. The congregation forcibly tossed the Episcopal priests and their new prayer book from the church before conducting a Presbyterian service. Message sent, I'd say. Can you imagine the mayhem? I'm wondering how he got out of there with his life. This is, after all, Scotland. Charles had lived in England too long and seemed to have forgotten the independent nature of his Scottish subjects. So he was attempting to force the Episcopalian form of worship upon them as a good example of his ignorance of Scottish sensibilities. This is like waving the red flag in front of the bull, yeah? They did not intend to accept this interference in their freedom to follow their own beliefs. They followed their own beliefs. That wasn't a request. So on the 28th of February, 1638, Presbyterians led by the Earl of Sutherland held a meeting at Greyfriars Kirkyard in Edinburgh, where they signed a document which reminded their king in faraway London that his subjects in the kingdom of Scotland were not English and were not to be treated as a part of England. The document, which became known as the Covenant, was signed by all those assembled at Greyfriars and later by many supporters. The Covenant promised to defend the worship of the forefathers against the king. All those who assented to this action, many noble families of Scotland, were known as the Covenanters. The king now had a very well-organized, very pissed-off general assembly of the Covenanters. We're demanding the abolition of the episcopacy, headed by Charles. Charles was always insistent on getting his own way. After all, he's close to divine. And he just, by this time, they settled down and then he'd strike. He's building up an army to force Scotland to obey him. Good move, huh? When the Covenanters realized what Charles was intending to do, they also formed an army and marched south to meet the forces. The matter came to a confrontation in Dunn's Law, Berkshire, May 1639. This, in history, we know this is the first Bishop's War. The king lost. He backed down and agreed to call both a General Assembly of the Church of Scotland and a Scottish Parliament. And this show of public opposition by the Scottish people had forced the king to rethink, and Charles yielded. The new prayer book, the bishops, and the wearing of surplices were all done away with. Charles, however, still wanted his will carried out, and when the Covenanters returned to Edinburgh, they found that he had issued a new order demanding the practices of the Episcopalian Church be adopted in Scotland. This time, he intended the command to be enforced by the Earl of Stafford. Stafford had already subdued Ireland, in the process creating an Irish standing army. And he was considered to be a hard enough man to take control of the Scots. All he needed was an English army, but Charles couldn't afford one without the financial support of the English Parliament. Stafford suggested bringing his Irish troops to England, but Charles was too afraid of an English backlash. So on the 13th of April, 1640, his shortage of money forced him to call a new parliament in London. And this new parliament refused to grant him any money. And so he was again pressed into illegal taxation, enforced by this very brutal knucklehead, Stafford. Now the king found the forces of parliament were ranged against him, and under the mild despotism of his period of personal rule, the landed gentry had established strong local control of local government in many parts of the country. They formed the parliament, and they were unhappy with the king, who denied their property rights and taxed them unlawfully. And eventually they came to rely on a strong leader amongst them. His name was John Pym. The Covenanters marched down as far as the River Tyne, where they faced the ramshackle assembly of conscripts, which was the only army that Stafford had been able to raise. Parliament and the Puritans of England supported the Scots, and the English army had little stomach for a fight. After a few days' standoff, the English fled and the Scots took Newcastle. Sir Winston Churchill describes the battle thus: "The Scots cannon fired and all the English fled.
Never have so many run from some few with less ado. At this moment, King Charles' moral position was at its worst. He had plumbed the depths of personal failure. He had no choice, Charles, but to deal with John Pym's House of Commons. Pym drove a hard bargain, and the Earl of Stafford's head was duly delivered at Tower Hill on the 12th of May, 1640. A little bit of the personal history of the Grahams. The Bonnie Dundee fought against the Covenanters for the king, and then he fought against the king for the Covenanters. Personal history. Always, always a challenge. The family, eh? Go figure. Some of you might remember a little bit of this. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece of music. 1939 by Vera.
Again, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that if you saw me gone, I was singing song. We'll meet again, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Imagine you and your buddies, me and my friends, singing that song, knowing that there was a good chance most of us weren't going to be ever meeting again. Thank goodness that there were. Thank God we could at least feel that support. Don't know where and don't know when. The dread of something after death, the undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveler returns, puzzles the will. It makes us rather bear those ills we have that fly to others that we know not of. Thus, conscience doth make cowards of us all. And thus the native hue of resolution is sicklied over the pale cast of thought. It's from Hamlet, Act 3. Just a little bit. Here, want to know a little bit about what we tend to forget? Easy parts, all woven into why. The question, I've been explaining my thoughts on this. When you go to a Masonic meeting, have a question in mind. It can pertain to that specific meeting or to life in general or to your purpose. Can you imagine going through your life and on your last day, having not thought about the meaning of your life or whether you served a purpose, realizing that all your life you've not really cared? Imagine that feeling of isolation and emptiness when you find it's too late. Yeah, I'd say that's fairly grim. So to preserve against that day, think about the meaning. Don't be caught up in every bit of mediocrity and your own ego-driven anxieties, what you didn't do yesterday and what calamity might happen tomorrow. You're not children. Grow up. You live in the moment. And be grateful for it. Not some pile of neuroses that's running around, wasting your breath. Live in the moment. Live today. Be with us. Be with us. All we can do. Importance, you can begin to wonder among yourself why we would ever strive for something, a deeper meaning of life. Well, here's a reading of a poem by A.E. Housman, by Richard Dawkins, that brings that, let me bring that point to you a little clearer than I can.
I'm going to read a poem by A.E. Housman, one of my favorite poets. This one is not from A Shropshire Lad, but it has the same hauntingly wistful air. I knew it by heart as a boy in love, not with any particular girl, but with the idea of being in love, and especially the tragedy of lost love. Much later, when I organized the funeral of my friend and mentor, the evolutionary biologist W.D. Hamilton, in New College Chapel, his sister chose the poem for her reading. I was not surprised to learn that it was one of Bill's favorites, because he had long brought to my mind the melancholy protagonist of A Shropshire Lad. In my book, River Out of Eden, I had earlier quoted, actually misquoted from memory, the last verse, when I wanted to convey the indifferent callousness of Darwinian natural selection, noted by Darwin himself. The politician Douglas Jay, who also loved Housman, pointed out my misquotation to me, and I gratefully corrected the error in later printings of the book. Here's the correct version of those two lines. For nature, heartless, witless nature, will neither care nor know. DNA neither cares nor knows. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. I find it all too easy to cry when reading poetry, so I hope I won't let myself down now. It's from Last Poems. Tell me not here, it needs not saying what tune the enchantress plays in aftermaths of soft September or under blanching Mays, for she and I were long acquainted, and I knew all her ways. On russet floors by waters idle, the pine lets fall its cone. The cuckoo shouts all day at nothing in leafy dells alone. And traveller's joy beguiles in autumn hearts that have lost their own. On acres of the seeded grasses, the changing burnish heaves, or marshalled under moons of harvest, stand still all night the sheaves. Or beeches strip in storms for winter, and stain the wind with leaves. Possess, as I possessed a season, the countries I resign, where over elmy plains the highway would mount the hills and shine, and full of shade the pillared forest would murmur and be mine. For nature, heartless, witless nature, would neither care nor know what stranger's feet may find the meadow and trespass there and go, nor ask amid the dews of morning if they are mine or no.
Sometimes things just make us sigh. I or no. Here. I'll say goodbye to David and leave you with this piece. Masonic as it comes. Masonic as rust on the bumper of a Buick. It's about Pythagoras of Crotona. Little explanation. Though Pythagoras excelled Plato in the profundity of his philosophical deductions, the transcendental element of his doctrines has provoked the ridicule of a materialistic modern science. All too lightly, the world has passed over the achievements of the first philosopher, to whom it is indebted for so many of the basic theorems of mathematics, music, and astronomy. The 20th century student of Greek philosophy has been taught to associate the name of Pythagoras with such puerile issues as his golden shin bone and his ban upon the eating of beans. It has also been held against Pythagoras that he delivered his discourses from behind a curtain, preached his allegories and enigmas, and revealed his scientific knowledge only to such initiated disciples as had spent many years of self-discipline. His scholastic critics, however, have failed to consider the manner in which Pythagoras obtained his immense wealth of abstract learning. The mysteries of Greece, Egypt, and Persia, and India, without exception, bound their initiates to inviolable secrecy. Having accepted the obligations of these societies, Pythagoras had no honorable course other than to abide by their regulations. Iamblichus lists 218 men and 17 women among the most famous of the Pythagorean philosophers. It is thus evident that Pythagoras revealed his secrets to a considerable number of persons, probably all who he felt could understand and be benefited by his knowledge. The Pythagorean doctrine of mathematical philosophy may yet be accepted as the one system of thought able to cope with the riddle of existence. I'm not so sure the author of that is giving us enough credit that we would ridicule from the position of a materialistic modern science. That just seems a slight harshness to that. And just help me to examine whether that has some validity in the modern world. We're gone for another week. I hope that the season of reflection weighs carefully on your shoulders. Not with any hypocritical notion of care that is not there, but be real. Think about the importance of those battlefields. It's the battle of Charles with his subject in Scotland, and the death of Stafford, serving the knucklehead moves of, you know, these Buckingham. Well, people were dying in all of that. Can you see, is there a point this many years on, This is 21st century. That was 17th century. This many years on, all of that seems almost pointless. Except people died. And for what? Better that they lived a good life and understood exactly their position. Because people like me will honor them regardless. Because I must. I hope you're doing well. We just passed a day stolen from Freemasons. A day of committing acts of random kindness. Man, if that doesn't smack a Freemason, I don't know what is. This is a little piece from Mark Mononoff that opens the start of one of the most beautiful lodges in Toronto. This is played by Elena Lasco. I look forward to seeing you all real soon. Take care of each other.